Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, Upgrade listeners. If you enjoy The Upgrade, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, won't you? More reviews means that more people find the podcast, which means we can keep doing the show and keep finding fascinating guests to interview for you, all for you. We have big plans for this show, but we need your help. 5 stars, please. Thank you. Go now. Wait, listen to the show first, but then right after. Go.
Go before you listen to the show.
Okay, pause.
Yep.
Rate, review.
It's a good one.
Write some good things. Then you can listen to the show.
It's a good show. So,
good show.
But you're not allowed to listen to it until you write the review.
Not allowed.
Hello, and welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And today we're talking about psychedelics with Michael Pollan. For over 30 years, Michael has been writing about the intersection of nature and culture. He may best be known as the guy who summed up his principles for eating thusly: eat food, not too much, mostly plants. He is the author of several books, including In Defense of Food, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and The Botany of Desire.
His latest book is How to Change Your Mind: What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence.
Welcome, Michael.
My pleasure.
As a journalist and author, you've covered food and our relationships with the things that we consume. What got you started on exploring psychedelics?
Well, long before I was writing about food, I was writing about nature and our engagement with the natural world, and specifically how nature changes us and how we change nature. I've always been curious about the different desires that we use plants and fungi to gratify. One is, of course, nourishment, sweetness, beauty. But there's this unusual one that I call changing consciousness. And almost all of us, and I'll bet everyone listening to this podcast at some point today, has used a plant to change consciousness. Whether it's coffee or tea or a cigarette or chocolate, this is just something we do. And I've always been curious about that. So, yes, food is a very important part of our engagement with the natural world, but so is this other desire. And it's always been in the back of my mind to take a good hard look at it. And then I started hearing about these kind of amazing and weird-sounding experiments using psilocybin to change people's consciousness and specifically to heal them.
So you've been on, obviously, a lot of podcasts and shows talking about this book. I'm wondering, what's the reception been from the general audience? What do you think people are thinking now about psychedelics?
I've been, frankly, amazed at the reception, that it's much stronger than I expected it to be, and actually much more reasonable and less moralistic or emotional. You know, I made a very conscious effort when I started doing this to speak about psychedelics in a very matter-of-fact way, as tools, you know, good or bad, rather than as these scary things that are disruptive to society and drive people crazy. And I found that, to a great extent, if you speak about something in a matter-of-fact way, people reciprocate. And this was true for mainstream media, for all the podcasts I've been on. So I've been very heartened by the fact that people seem able to have a pretty reasonable conversation about this topic, which, you know, as you know, has always been laden with a lot of political and moralistic baggage. Mm-hmm. So it's been, on the whole, very gratifying. And I think that it reflects some shift in the culture that may be willing at long last to take psychedelics out of their 60s, you know, the brand that they were given in the 60s, and take a fresh look at them.
Any guesses as to why that is? Why people are more receptive now?
I think there are a couple reasons. I think one is the 60s are fading finally, even though they've had such a hold on our politics and our worldview for a long time. There is now a generation rising that's pretty innocent of that period. But another reason, and I think a more important one, is the fact that mental health treatment and mental health care in this country is really in big trouble. And we have a tremendous problem with depression, suicide, addiction, rates of which are going up very rapidly. And we don't have many tools to treat them. The last big innovation in mental health care would be the SSRI antidepressants, really, in the late 80s, early 90s. And since then, not that much has happened. And yet the need has gotten more and more acute. So along comes this research, which suggests that these tools may be useful and have a role to play in relieving what is a profound amount of suffering in the world. Now, we don't know this for sure. We haven't completed the research, and what we have are strong signals in the data that there's something here that could help a lot with depression, addiction, obsession, and the anxiety and depression people have as they approach their death.
And unlike SSRIs and antidepressants, as I understand it, there really are no side effects. Isn't that right?
The drugs are much less toxic than most other psychiatric medicines. LSD and psilocybin are remarkably non-toxic. There is no lethal dose. You have over-the-counter drugs in your medicine cabinet that have a lethal dose and are more toxic to your body, to your liver, and other organs. So that's kind of remarkable. But the other important difference from the SSRIs is you don't take these drugs every day for the rest of your life. You have one or possibly two or three experiences or sessions that are really the agent of change rather than this, you know, steady drip of novel chemicals into your bloodstream. And so that's a big difference. Psychedelic therapy, which really should be called psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, is a novel hybrid of pharmacology and talk therapy where people have one big experience, and if it works, that experience resets their minds in very important ways.
And so that's happening right now, but it's not legal, correct?
Well, it's legal when it's being done in universities, and there are these trials going on at NYU, Johns Hopkins, UCLA, and a bunch of other sites are about to get started later this year or early next year. So the FDA has approved the use in these contexts, and the drugs are on a path toward acceptance as a medicine by the FDA. When that happens, any MD will be able to prescribe them. Mm. And remarkably, we're only a few years away from that. If these larger trials that are getting underway later this year do as well as the phase two trials and the pilot studies we've had, there's a very good chance that the FDA will approve these medicines.
We did an episode on microdosing, and we had a psychotherapist in the studio who was using MDMA and psychedelics, working with people who had depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. And he spoke about how difficult it was to get these studies underway because of the Schedule I status of most psychedelics.
There is a kind of underdog component to it, right? A sort of a reevaluation of potentially a lost tool. And that I maybe I have something in me that kind of likes that idea of sort of fighting for something that at face value may not have the best chance. That's sort of the terrible part of the history, is that even the potential to, or the possibility to evaluate whether this works or not, was kind of off the table for a few decades.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on with those studies and how things have changed?
Yeah, well, the FDA is actually being surprisingly encouraging. They're resolved to treat these drugs like any other drugs without attention to the fact that they're illicit. And so far, they've approved most of the studies coming through. There have not been studies yet of microdosing. And I think it's really important for people to understand that, because there's so many people right now who are microdosing, and yet they're doing it on the basis of purely anecdotal information. No trials have been done to test the idea of microdosing. And there's some trials that may get underway soon, but it's purely anecdotal information. And I'm very curious to see if it holds up when you have a serious drug trial. MDMA, that's a very different kind of research, and that is well underway. In fact, MDMA, which is the abbreviations of the chemical name for ecstasy, has been tried with quite a bit of success in the treatment, as you suggest, of post-traumatic stress disorder. And in fact, they had a phase two trials. They're basically three phases of FDA approved trials. And phase two is a middling sized trial of, a couple dozen patients. And they found there that in 2/3 of the cases, 67%, the people who had PTSD after their MDMA treatment did not register as having PTSD on the standard scale, which is quite remarkable and far superior to any other treatment we have for that. So that work is moving on to phase three and is probably going to be the first of these illicit drugs to be approved as medicine. We should see that in a couple years.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
What happens in the brain during a psychedelic experience?
Well, we're not entirely sure. We know that the drugs lock on to the serotonin receptor, one particular one, the 5-2-A serotonin receptor, which is very common in the cortex and, oddly enough, in the gut. And that is the same receptor that serotonin works on. And it seems to create a cascade of events from that locking in that leads to a suppression of activity in something called the default mode network. When they image the brains of people on psychedelics, they kind of expected to see lots of fireworks, you know, to correspond to what people were reporting of hallucinations, synesthesia, hearing voices. So, but what they were surprised to find is that this one very important network, which is a hub in the brain and kind of a regulator of the whole neural symphony, it's kind of the conductor, went down. Was down-regulated. And so what does the default mode network do? Well, it's involved in several very important functions related to giving you a sense of having a consistent self over time. Something the Buddhists have told us is an illusion, but most of us feel is very real. So the default mode network is involved in self-reflection and rumination and self-criticism. It's involved in something called theory of mind. That's the ability to imagine the fact that someone else has subjective experiences of reality, which is very important to moral reasoning and ethical reasoning. It's involved in time travel, the ability to think about the past or the future. And if you think about it, that is very important to having a sense of self continuous over time. And it's involved in something called the experiential or the narrative self. And this is where we generate the stories we tell ourselves about who we are and connect new things that happen to us to those narratives to give us that sense of continuity. All this is muted or goes offline, and that probably explains why people often report a sense of ego dissolution, that suddenly their sense of self has melted into nature, into the universe, and they feel themselves merging with something larger than themselves, which can be terrifying. It is a kind of death to lose yourself. But if you're prepared for it and you surrender to it, it can be quite ecstatic. That is the unitive experience of the mystical experience that William James described more than 100 years ago. So that seems to be what's going on in the brain based on fMRI imaging, which is not a perfect technology, but it's the best we have for figuring out what's going on in human brains. But using another technology, they were able to image the brains of people after their default mode network had quieted. And what they found there was fascinating. And in fact, I reproduce a map of the brain's wiring on psychedelics versus the placebo. And what you see is that all these brain networks that don't normally talk to one another suddenly are in communication. New connections are formed in the brain. We don't know what those connections are doing exactly, but the fact is dots are being connected in new ways, and that may produce new insights, new metaphors, synesthesia, the cross-wiring of different senses. But this temporary rewiring that may help jog people's minds out of their stuck place. And of course, that's what depression, obsession, addiction, and anxiety are. They're minds that are stuck in grooves of thinking that they can't get out of.
And you've talked about that coming down from the sort of highest part of the trip is actually some of the most profound moments you've had, if I'm getting that right, that you said that you're the most productive and that you've been able to sort of think creatively during that time.
Yeah, there's a part of the psychedelic experience that doesn't get talked about very much because it's not as dramatic as the big show in the middle where you're having these hallucinations and you're traveling into your body or you're meeting the dead or all the different things that can happen. But there's this long denouement after that's over. You're not hallucinating. You're in a meditative state. And it's a very productive kind of cognitive space, I found, where you can actually direct your thoughts to one topic or another. You're not easily distracted. The outside world still does not intrude. You know, I mean, when I say get some work done, I don't mean like, you know, write a memo or a report or anything, but think about stuff you want to think about. Think about relationships. Think about creative projects you're involved with. And I found that one of the most interesting and surprising parts of the experience, and one that I hadn't really been prepared for and don't read that much about. It's sort of like hypnagogic consciousness. It's that's that mode of consciousness right before you fall asleep. Images and little snatches of narrative might appear, and you're not quite asleep. You're not quite awake. It's a liminal space in between two states. And I found it very productive, yeah, and pleasant, too.
What was your experience with psychedelics before you started on this research?
I had not done psychedelics when you're supposed to in college. Or in your 20s or teenage years. I was, you know, there was a couple of reasons. I came of age at a time when the scare stories about LSD were all over the culture. And people were jumping off of buildings. People were staring at the sun till they went blind. I mean, I heard it all and I believed it all. It turns out a lot of that isn't true. But without question, there are risks, and people do get into psychological trouble from time to time. But I was afraid. And I also didn't, I think I was a sturdy enough person to do psychedelics. I just wasn't sure that I had the mental stability to withstand this assault. And so I stayed away. And really, I had a couple experiences with mushrooms in my 20s, but they were not ego-dissolving. You know, they weren't non-dual experiences, as people say. There were museum or aesthetic experiences. Interesting, but not profound. So it really wasn't until I was in my late 50s and had embarked on this project that I began exploring psychedelics and had a series of trips on different substances that were really transformative.
So tell us about these experiences you had. You said you had one with psilocybin, one with LSD, and one with the smoked venom of the Sonoran desert toad.
Yes, that was the weirdest of all. This is a psychedelic produced by this toad. You milk the toad, essentially. It has these glands. I didn't do this, but the woman who administered the medicine to me, you basically gently squeeze these glands on its side or on its legs onto a sheet of glass, and then it dries overnight into this crystal that looks like brown sugar, and then you smoke that. That was my least pleasant and most terrifying trip. You know, the best thing I could say about that trip is it was very brief. It was only about 20 minutes. But it was absolute obliteration of any categories of experience. I'm talking about self, gone, time, gone, place or space, gone. It was just this existing in this field of pure energy, but it wasn't a calm field. It was a stormy field. I mean, I felt like I had this Category 5 hurricane in my head. It was really not fun. The best thing about it was coming down and realizing, oh my God, the world still exists. Not only am I alive, I mean, all of us have expressed gratitude for being alive, I think, but I felt gratitude for the fact that there is something rather than nothing, because I had experienced absolute nothingness, lack of time, lack of matter. So it was the most profound feeling of gratitude I've ever had. And, you know, I guess you could say that was the benefit of the trip, but it was a long way to go for that that sensation. But the more positive experiences were the guided LSD and psilocybin trips. I think it's important for listeners to understand that the way these drugs are being used in this therapeutic context, and that's the context in which I was approaching it, is very different than the image people have of, you know, taking a handful of mushrooms and going to a concert or walking on the beach. You're guided. There's somebody with you who is an experienced facilitator or often a therapist of one kind or another. And they prepare you very carefully for the experience. They tell you what to expect and what to do if you get into trouble. They explain that you may have this sensation of going crazy or dying or you're self-dissolving, but that you should always go with it. Don't resist. And it's when you resist that you have a very anxious and possibly paranoid experience that people would typically call a bad trip. But if you're willing to go wherever it goes, open any door that is presented to you, go climb any staircase that you see, just don't run away. So that's very important advice. During the experience, you're wearing eye shades, and that's a weird idea for people who've used psychedelics before, but the idea is to encourage a very inward journey, that you're not sort of grooving on the sensory input coming in, but you're really looking inside yourself. And you're wearing headphones or listening to music that's been designed to orchestrate the experience and kind of reflects the arc of the experience and actually ends up being very profound. It's blocking out other sensory information like street noise, but it's also kind of setting the table because music becomes more powerful than it's ever been in your life. It actually is not just one sense, but is generating all the senses. Mm. It's a landscape that you're in that is actually generated by the music. Very hard to explain.
You said you had some difficulty with the music, actually, and you had your one guy change around.
Oh, I had such a problem with the music, yeah. So a couple of my guides seem to have a weakness for sort of new age music, the kind of stuff that would be fine if you were getting a nice massage in a high-end spa, but for a, you know, deep exploration of your psyche just seemed completely wrong. So I had a lot of arguments with my guides about music. Although we finally hit on some music that was wonderful. Toward the end of this psilocybin trip, we put on Bach unaccompanied cello suites, which are gorgeous pieces of music. Yo-Yo Ma on the cello, nothing else. Very sad, but beautiful music. Yeah, that worked for me. So I lean toward classical or kind of neutral, you know, Brian Eno. Mm-hmm. Philip Glass. Kind of spatialized music without a lot of manipulative emotional content.
No didgeridoos for you?
I avoid the didgeridoos and other, you know, tribal flutes of various kinds. Not my thing.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
So what's the fallout like now?
The main fallout, I think, is a greater sense of openness, a greater sense of patience, a greater emotional availability, all of which flowed from a very profound experience I had on psilocybin of watching my ego, my sense of self, completely crumble. First, it was dispersed into little pieces of paper, like Post-its. Then it appeared to me as a coat of paint on the world, you know, out there. But I beheld this from a new point of view I'd never had before. And it was a very objective, uninvested, dispassionate, yet compassionate point of view that I had never viewed the world from this. I'd always assumed that I was identical to my ego. Mm. And most of us, I think, do, that chattering voice in our heads telling us what to do, you know, the perfectionist, the person urging us on or criticizing us, is us, but it isn't. It's a function of your mind or your brain. It's not the be-all and end-all of who you are. So having had that brief experience of another ground on which to stand as a human being and deal with the information coming in, the challenges of everyday life, that was mind-opening because I realized, oh, I don't have to deal with things that way. There is this other point of view, and that, you know, so it gave me some perspective on my ego that I hadn't had before and a little bit of distance on it. And even though I can't claim that other perspective whenever I want to, I can attain it sometimes in meditation. And one of the big fallouts for me is I am much more serious about my meditation practice. Because it is in meditation that you can achieve a very similar outlook on life. And as different as people might think a psychedelic trip and meditation are, they actually have a lot in common. They both quiet the voice of the self. They both, when it works, replace it with this disembodied awareness that is very unbothered by everything. So that's been the takeaway for me. And I think it's had positive effects on, I think I'm less defensive than I was. I think when I'm being defensive, I recognize it. I have this little spectrum in my head now that I got from some of the scientists I interviewed of when am I feeling contracted and when am I feeling expanded? And I think that those are really interesting terms. And I think if you give it a little thought, in any mental state, you can kind of place it on that spectrum. And the less defensive, less egocentric view is the expanded. Ego is really about contraction and defending, and you know that little insect that curls into a ball to defend itself against the world. That's the ego. I learned something about my mind, and I learned something about the mind, and that's a pretty big deal.
It sounds, you hearing you say this, it sounds like this is something that everybody should do at least once in their lives.
Well, that's not for me to say. You know, I mean, I don't think it's for everyone. I think that you have to be in a certain state of mind where you can benefit from it, and you're curious enough and willing, mm-hmm. as I had to be, to overcome a very profound reluctance to surrender. I mean, you know, I'm a bit of a control freak. So that idea of, you know, relax your mind and float downstream, as my guide told me to do, was not easy. And I had a lot of anxiety before I did this. Every trip was preceded by a sleepless night. And it was my ego saying, are you crazy? You know, you're going to go up on this mountain. You could have a heart attack. And is this underground guide going to call the ambulance? Maybe not, because he's going to put himself at great risk. All these arguments. And then the other side of me was saying, but aren't you curious? Don't you want to have this experience? You have a book to write. In the end, you know, luckily my ego lost that argument. And I understand why my ego was making it, because it was about to be assaulted. It was defending itself. And the ego is very clever and has control of your rational faculties. So it makes very good arguments most of the time. So overcoming that took something. All of which is just to say it's not for everybody. It's not for someone who is at risk for serious mental illness, schizophrenia or personality disorder or bipolar. I mean, people with those indications are usually excluded from the trials. If you are thinking of doing it, I'd strongly recommend you do it with a guide, that it really minimizes the risks, because there are risks. They're not physical risks, substantially. They're psychological risks of having a bad trip, of going to a very dark place you can't get out of. And when you have a guide at your side, you're much more likely, they'll know what to say to help you break through that if you get into that groove. One other thing I need to tell you, it's illegal. So that's a very good reason not to do it. There's a certain amount of legal risk, and some people don't feel comfortable breaking the law for whatever reason. I had to get my head around that. I was reluctant also, but it became very important to me, and I was willing to take the risk. So it's for people willing to take the risks, and there are risks involved.
And how did you get around that? Just for our audience, I think that's probably the question you get all the time. When a friend of mine heard I was going to be speaking with you, she said, could you just ask him for his hookup for mushrooms?
Yeah, I know. I have gotten that question from literally hundreds of people, and where do I find a guide? And it would be unfair to anyone for me to make recommendations,
right,
just because I would be jeopardizing. I mean, if there's anyone more exposed now on this topic, it's me. And so for me to try to hook people up would be to endanger everybody involved.
Right.
So I'm not doing that.
No. So what do you tell people, though?
Start by doing some reading. There's a wonderful book called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide by Jim Fadiman that has a lot of information about guiding and not where to find guides, but what they do. And if you don't have a guide, how to help, how a friend could guide you or how you could guide somebody else. And it's got very good advice. I also encourage people to look at my website, where I've posted a substantial section of resources that, for example, lists all the psychedelic societies in the country. There are more than 100 now. And these are groups of people very interested in psychedelics who meet not to do them, but to talk about them. And my guess is if you began attending those meetings, you would find guides, you would get recommendations once you got to know the people involved. And, you know, if you read the website carefully, I think you'll see that there is some general advice on how to find your way into this community, which is what I did as a journalist. And, you know, getting one person to ask another. And ask around. You might be surprised that there are people in your circle who have experience. A lot of people are very closeted about this. And I've found that since this book came out, that many people are more willing to come out of the closet and talk about their experiences. And I've been amazed how many people have experiences and know people in this community. So it may be, you know, not as exotic as you think, finding your way through.
So you mentioned, like, going to Amsterdam where certain kinds of psilocybin are legal. How far is our society from a place where you can walk into the corner shop and buy a truffle, a psychedelic truffle?
That's the form in which psilocybin is sold in Amsterdam. I think we're quite a ways from that. I think what will happen first, it's not going to be like cannabis. I mean, there are people who want to put psilocybin on the ballot and approve it like cannabis, and I don't think that's going to work. And I don't know that it should work. These are more powerful drugs, and I think that their use needs to be very carefully regulated. And I'm not sure what that regulatory regime should look like, but I don't think it should be anything goes. I just think that they're too powerful. So the path we're on is going to, if it works as planned, will turn psilocybin into an FDA-approved medicine. At that point, the government will reschedule it. And so instead of being Schedule 1, where it is now, which means that it has no recognized medical use and a high potential for abuse, both of which aren't true, by the way, but that's where it is now, it'll get rescheduled to Schedule 2 or 3. At that point, any MD, theoretically, should be able to prescribe it. And psychiatrists will be the ones, presumably, who prescribe it. Now, does that mean anyone could get use of it? Well, you know, lots of people go to see therapists who aren't, you know, mentally ill. They're unhappy. They're trying to solve a problem, fix a relationship. And very often those therapists will recommend an antidepressant or some other drug. And you could absolutely see those therapists recommending psilocybin and organizing journeys for people, perhaps in their offices. Beyond that, though, I do think that there should be some way to advance what one researcher memorably called the betterment of well people, that these drugs do have something to offer people who aren't mentally ill, people who are stuck in bad habits of thought or behavior, people who want to explore their mind, or people who want to have spiritual experiences. There is another legal place to use these drugs, and that is in certain religious contexts. The Native American Church, for example, has federal permission to use peyote. There are two ayahuasca churches operating in America, and if you join those churches, you can legally use ayahuasca in their ceremonies. So I think we have to be creative and figure out other contexts in which people might be able to have access to these medicines.
Yeah. Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And now it's time for our upgrade of the week. Every week, we talk about that one tiny thing that's making a big difference in our lives. Joining us for upgrade this week is producer Levi Sharp. Hey, Levi.
Hello.
But I'm going to go to Melissa first for her upgrade. Melissa, what's your upgrade this week?
I bought a new keyboard for my computer at home. It's a Mac keyboard. I've sprung for the expensive one that is like 9 feet long with the number pad. And the more recent vintage Mac keyboards are almost completely flat. Mm-hmm. This is the Bluetooth keyboard. It might be called the Magic keyboard, but they call way too many things magic, so it doesn't matter. It's
You're
the long
cheapening
one.
The word.
It has no wires. You charge it every now and then. It's too flat compared to my off-brand wireless keyboard, Bluetooth connection keyboard that I was using before. So I looked all over the place online to find people complaining about this. So first I found my community, and indeed there are people that are upset about how flat it is. And then I found some sort of instructions for how to build feet for the back of the keyboard and was planning on doing that when I realized, you know what, I could just get like those rubber feet that you put on the bottom of chairs to keep mm-hmm. them from scraping up the floor. And they're about exactly the height that I wanted to lift the back of the keyboard. So I bought these rubber stick-on feet for the keyboard and slanted it at the perfect angle for me. And I was so psyched about this. And then I looked on Lifehacker to see if I had ergonomically set up my desk appropriately, because that's what you do. You make a change to something that you can't undo, and then you look to see
sure.
if it was
Makes
good
sense.
For you. And evidently, the ergonomic way to position your keyboard is away from you
yeah.
so that it's like slanting down
Flipping
away
down.
From you. So exactly
really?
The opposite of what I did. Yeah.
Then why do laptops, why do they go the other way?
Well, laptops are generally flat, right? Like,
yeah. But yeah. I mean, like well, looking at yours right now, there is a slant
right.
towards
so,
you as opposed to away.
So if you hold your wrists over the keyboard and you sort of let your fingers fall naturally, they're
uh-huh.
going to, you know, they're going away from you, right? Like the
okay.
natural position of your hands, I guess, mm-hmm. is with your fingers slanted away from you when you bend at the wrist.
Because this compresses, if you tilt your hand up, you're actually compressing the nerves.
In your wrist?
Supposedly, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. so I basically altered my pricey keyboard in a way that is ergonomically damaging to me, but I've never been happier. And no pain yet, so it's a huge upgrade.
First of all, you could remove those little feet and put
no,
them the other way if you
not.
Wanted to. You can't, that's it?
No.
Okay.
I can't because I was so proud of myself. Yes,
sure.
I could just peel sure. them off, sure.
What I'm going to say, though, is that I have used an ergonomic keyboard and had wrist pain because you're not used to that kind of position
yes.
and it feels very strange.
Yes.
And I think the strangeness itself makes you tense up and doesn't
totally.
Do good things for the nerve engagement.
Right.
And I support you in your,
right.
your
Moral
feet.
Moral of the story, don't listen to the experts.
Don't listen to
me.
Lifehacker.
Never listen to Lifehacker. Listen to Lifehacker's editor.
Yes.
But I'm pretty happy with the situation with my keyboard now. And I even put the feet on my keyboard at work
mm-hmm.
because there's no stopping me.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're never defeated.
Oh, gosh.
Levi, what's your upgrade?
My upgrade is Instagram. And it's using Instagram to find art. My girlfriend Caitlin and I have decided that we would like to decorate our apartments and make it feel more like we're adults. And so we're buying like real furniture, not just IKEA stuff. And instead of just buying, you know, prints or posters or whatever, we're looking for artists that we like on Instagram and just reaching out to them
mm-hmm.
and seeing how much their stuff costs. We can't spend so much on art. We found an artist in Australia whose work we really liked, and, you know, her pieces ranged from like 150 to like 300, and that's kind of the range that we're in. And it was fantastic.
I've used Instagram to just for like inspiration for mm-hmm. art, for like to when I'm making my own art.
Yeah. So, upgrade of the week, use Instagram to find artists and please buy more art. Just buy more art.
There's a lot of really talented artists out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Etsy's a good resource as well.
Etsy's good too.
Yeah.
Alice, what's your upgrade?
Well, I have started going to a craniosacral therapist.
I have no idea what that is.
Just rolled her eyes so hard. First of all, my doctor, my real GP, who's a doctor, who's a real doctor, recommended this acupuncturist who I've been going to for my jaw because I've had jaw pain.
I've been going to this acupuncturist as well.
Okay, so you know that she's great. So she told me, go to this craniosacral therapist for your jaw pain. She's going to knock this right out of you. I swear to God, she's amazing. She's a real healer.
And the acupuncture didn't work.
It worked a tiny bit, but it kind of would like revert really quickly back to the normal, just tense jaw situation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So I went once and I can't really describe what, I don't exactly know what she does. They basically do this very light hands-on manipulation, but it's like just gently cradling your head and then like putting a hand on your hip and just leaving it there for a little bit. And she'd be like, oh, your left hip is weird. And I'm like, yes, actually. So I left there and I was like, well, that didn't really do too much, but it seemed okay. And my jaw completely stopped hurting me, completely was, and she barely touched my jaw. And I was like, I am sold. Whatever she's selling, I'm buying.
Weird.
So I went back yesterday and had the most profound experience. It was like life-altering. Now I feel like I'm going to go to her every day. Like she can just have all my money. It's crazy. It was like being on drugs. She would like put her hands on my sort of like underneath me on my back, and I could feel bones moving around. Memories were coming up, and weird pains would appear and then disappear. And then, like, it'd feel like my hip was realigning. And she'd be like, wow, did you feel that? Your hip just totally moved. And I was like, oh my God, I feel that. And then at the end, she was just cradling my head. And I was like, I couldn't talk. She'd be like, how are you doing? And I'm like, I can't. I was so relaxed in this amazingly profound way I've never been before.
This is a huge recommendation.
It was quick. And I will say, like, you know, I've looked up stuff about craniosacral therapy. I can't, like, blanket recommend just you guys got to go to anybody that, you know, you should go to. But, like, if you find somebody who's really good, I think it's really worth it. I mean, my jaw is 100% better. My back is better. I felt taller when she was done.
Had your salary gone up?
I'm more beautiful than I was.
Yeah.
I'm double married somehow. I don't know exactly how that happened.
Yeah.
Are you sure she didn't slip you some of that, like, frog poison?
I am not sure about anything. Honestly, it was so much like being on drugs. It was really crazy.
Cannot wait to go.
I'm skeptical, but, I mean, I'd give it a shot.
I'm still skeptical, but I'm for 100% going to go back.
Because I hurt all the time. Like, I have a lot of body pain.
Oh, if nothing else, it's incredibly relaxing.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Levi Sharp. Our executive director of audio is Mandana Mofidi. Our theme music is by Slowbiz. Our audio intern is Rachel Withers. And Jamie Colazzo mixed the episode.
Do you want to say hello to us? We want you to say hello to us. That was very well said. Email us at upgrade@lifehacker.com or do something no one ever does ever and leave us a voice message at 347-687-8109.
Follow Life Hacker on Twitter at Life Hacker and on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. And if you know what's good for you, you'll go to Apple Podcasts and write a 5-star review of The Upgrade. Come on, people. It's important. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.